This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi everyone, I'm Jim Poplava.
And I'm Kathleen Harris.
And welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income on the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, part of this week's show is pretty closely related to the shows we've done probably over the last 2 weeks. We've talked about Social Security benefits. Last week, we talked about veterans benefits and Medicare. But something's coming up here on October 1st. Enrollment in the insurance exchanges, which were created under the Affordable Care Act, starts on October 1st. So our special guest this week is Herb Schultz, who's the regional director of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and he's going to be giving us some details on that insurance exchange, what you need to do if you need to sign up, and we're going to try to make this pretty easy.
And for the first half of our program, we'll be discussing an issue that seems to be a pretty big sticking point for a lot of people that we've been doing financial plans for, and I'm talking about a second home. It's estimated that about 40% of baby boomers are planning to have second homes in retirement, so I'm sure that's going to include a lot of our listeners and the generations after them. So this just seems to be a big desire for our clients in terms of their dreaming about their retirement planning and how they kind of view their lives looking in retirement. For a lot of clients that we talk to, a second home is usually a vacation home, and it's a big part of how they see themselves living in retirement. But sometimes the second home can end up being a little bit of a trap. Without really good planning and strategizing for how to fund that home, it can turn out to be more of a nightmare than a dream home.
And if you think about it, the first big choice when you're talking about a second home is, okay, when to purchase it, how to pay for it. Now, putting money down on a second home in retirement means that a significant portion of your nest egg is now no longer available to produce income for you. So you want to decide how much of a down payment and what amount makes sense given all mortgage rates and what your payments are going to be and what that relation is to your overall nest egg and, more importantly, your monthly budget.
I think that there are really two ways to approach this. Number one, if your budget's a little bit less flexible, you can determine how big of a monthly mortgage payment and monthly upkeep for the second home your budget will support, and then do some backwards calculations to figure out how much mortgage you can afford. There's some really good online calculators to help you figure this out. Bankrate.com has one, Zillow.com has one, Bloomberg.com has one, CNNMoney.com has one. Basically, any financial website out there pretty much is going to have some kind of a mortgage calculator. So that's what you do if essentially your budget's a little bit less flexible. If you've got a little bit more flexibility in your budget where the monthly upkeep isn't so much of a big deal, what you may want to do is weigh the interest rate currently being offered on mortgages versus what that same money might be able to earn in terms of bond interest or dividends, for example, and then make a weighting towards whichever one of those is going to pay you a higher percentage. And sort of weight your decision in terms of what you make as a down payment toward the higher of those two.
Most of our clients, Kathleen, do a pretty good job for planning for the purchase price of a second home in retirement. They know how much they're going to put as a down payment. They've earmarked the specific funds for the purchase, and they've done a pretty good job of planning well for the impact that buying that home is going to have on their retirement spending. Because if you're financing it, obviously that's another mortgage payment. There's property taxes. You may have HOA fees, utilities, all the expenses that go with maintaining a second residence. What they often, though, fail to plan for is furnishing and maintaining the house.
I was doing a little bit of research on this, Jim, to prepare for this segment we were doing, and I was a little bit shocked at how much decorators estimate you should be spending to furnish your home. So here's some numbers from some different decorator websites. Most decorators estimate that if you're going for more of your basic furnishings, you're going to be spending between $50 to $60 per square foot. If you're looking at sort of a mid-range decoration of your house, you're looking at around $75 to $85 per square foot. And if you're going to go for the deluxe home furnishings, you're looking at between $100 to $110 per square foot for luxury furnishings. So for a 3,000 square foot home, which is pretty average, that's $150,000 minimum and $330,000 or more maximum spending just on home furnishings. Other online budgeting tools say that you should plan to spend at least 25% of your home's purchase price in decorating the home. And then I thought, okay, so you've got the inside of the home taken care of. What about the outside of the home? What about the landscaping? So I did a little research on landscaping costs, and turns out that most landscaping projects are usually between $3,000 and $9,000 a pop. So if you've got a couple projects, maybe you want your backyard resurfaced, maybe you want to add a deck, you start doing a couple of those and they start to really add up. You could probably end up spending between another $20,000 to $30,000 to $50,000 just on your landscaping. So again, once you've bought the home, you've got a plan for putting stuff inside the home and taking care of the outside of the home as well.
Well, you know, as you're talking about buying and furnishing the home, when you think about it, they're usually one-time expenses. But here's the thing that often catches people. The recurring expenses are often what breaks the retirement budget. You know, think about what happens to property taxes, utilities, HOA fees. I had a client over 5 years, the HOA fees almost doubled as a result of a number of lawsuits in the association. Then there's, of course, the maintenance, there's the insurance. And some of the estimates place these costs around $700 a month or more. And that's not including repairs, improvements, or not taking into consideration the mortgage payment. So if you think about it, the down payment, the mortgage payment, the property taxes, the HOA fees. If your retirement budget is tight already, you haven't planned for the monthly cost of upkeep on a second home, you may want to consider some of the other options.
I think we talked about this a few months ago on the show, Jim. We were talking with a client who was working on a retirement plan with us, and she and her husband had purchased a vacation home. It was actually a vacation condo, and they spent a lot of time there. Her husband unfortunately passed away quite unexpectedly fairly young. And so she had this vacation home that she really just didn't feel like visiting anymore because it just had too many associations, but she wasn't really ready to sell it. So she and I started penciling out how much she was actually spending on the home every year in terms of mortgage payments and upkeep, taxes, etc. It turned out at the end of the day, even though she was doing a seasonal rental on the property, she was going in the hole anywhere between $15,000 and $20,000 a year on this property. And so it was a really hard decision for her, but once she took a look at the numbers and realized that there was no way her budget was going to work with maintaining this property, she made the decision to go ahead and sell the home. But again, it was just one of those situations where the upkeep was just killing the budget.
And this brings into another consideration about second homes. A number of our clients have built or purchased homes in what I call dream locations. Sometimes these locations are remote or rural, you know, maybe great for fishing, hunting, plenty of room to garden, good neighbors. But what happens if one of you passes away? Will the surviving spouse still want to keep the second home, or will he or she have enough friends or hobbies there to justify owning that home? If not, whether or not the home has a reasonable rental or resale value becomes important because the chances of a remaining spouse using the home almost becomes nil. And I've seen this take place over and over again. We've done a number of case studies. For example, we had a couple that had a second home in Mammoth, but it turned out when they take a look at the cost of the mortgage payments, the maintenance of the place, property taxes, all of that adding up for only 2 weeks out of the year, they eventually sold it because it was much cheaper just to go up there and rent a hotel. So before you buy or build, ask yourself a couple of questions. If we need to sell or rent the property, how hard is that going to be? That's number one. Number two, how long is it going to take? And we often have to deal with this sometimes with heirs, and that becomes important. What kind of money can we expect if we sell it? Because, I mean, did anybody ever think housing prices would go down in the last decade? I mean, they'd never done that for a half a century, but they did. Because the last thing you want to do is have your dream or second home become a source of frustration and challenges for your spouse, especially should something happen to you.
You know, Jim, this actually happened to one of our clients. We had a client who she and her husband had moved from California up to a rural location in Idaho, and they just were loving it. They were doing all this fishing and camping and hunting and really loved the people and were having a great time. They'd only been up there for about a year, year and a half, and the husband passed away. Again, unexpectedly, very young. The wife was now in this remote location, very far from family. Even though she had made some friends with the neighbors, she hadn't been there long enough to really have a strong network. And so she was sort of stranded up there. And it was very hard for her family to make it up there to assist her, which was one problem. And the other problem was, even though their home was beautiful, it was absolutely gorgeous, custom designed, beautiful piece of property. Let's face it, the property just was not in an area that was going to sell very well. And so here we are a couple years later, and she still hasn't been able to sell that property. So for a couple of years, she's been eating up all those maintenance costs on a property she's not even using anymore.
You know, Kathleen, you bring up a key point. I mean, right now the real estate market is picking up, but think of what selling real estate has been like for the last 4 or 5 years. So when you think about the ability to resell or rent a property, you know, that can be an issue of the dream home turning out to be not so dreamy, because those realities exist. You know, if you own a home, you have maintenance, you know, you have property taxes, there's repairs, all of those things. And then later on, sometimes you'll see where actually what was once a dream home or a second home, as you get older, you don't use it as often, but you know, the burdens of the payments are still there, the property taxes and all that maintenance.
I was going to say too, Jim, I think the other thing is that as what sometimes happens with our dreams, the dream gets realized and we realize, the dream isn't really what we thought it was going to be. Just again, another example, I've mentioned we've had clients who've moved to rural areas in Idaho and Montana. And I'm from Idaho and I love it there, don't get me wrong. But you've got people moving up there from California and other places that are a lot more populated. And they move up there and they spend a couple months hiking and fishing, and then they're not really doing anything. They get a little stir crazy and it drives them insane. They miss all the things to do. They miss the entertainment. They miss the museums. They miss the shopping. They miss the bustle. They miss the hustle. They miss all the people around, the things to do. And so now they're stuck with a property that they really just don't want to be around anymore because the lifestyle just was a little too slow for them. So I think one of the things you want to do before you actually buy a second home or buy this vacation home is, you know, spend a lot of time there. Spend a significant vacation there, 3 to 6 months in that location. See if you can really handle the pace of life. Is it truly the dream that you think that it is, or is it a little bit less dreamy than you think?
You know, this relates to somebody that's getting ready to retire. Let's say they grew up on the East Coast. They're selling the big house, and they think they wanted to retire in Florida. Maybe they're not sure what city or community that they're in. It's also a good recommendation. If you're selling the big house and you're moving to another state, it may make a lot of sense to rent maybe for the first 6 months. Get to know the area and say, hey, do I really want to live here? Maybe you're moving there because you think your kids are close by, and guess what? The kid gets transferred. We've seen that happen. So, you know, Kathleen, this also applies when you're selling the big house, moving to another city, even if it's a city in the same state that you're living in now, always a good idea to rent first for the first 6 months or year. Get to really know the real estate market, know the areas of town. You may discover where you first wanted to live is not entirely where you want to live now. Once you've been there for a while, you find out there's better neighborhoods, or maybe there's another neighborhood that's closer to the kind of activities and things that you want to do. So this not only applies to, let's say, buying that dream second home, vacation home, it also applies to relocation. Maybe you're an executive, you're working for a company, and all of a sudden the company transfers you to another state. Well, you just sold your house, and the first thing I'm sure, you know, the women and the family's thinking, we need to buy a house, get settled. Well, where you initially want to buy, the house you want to buy may not be the ideal house. So really take a lot of experts say, it's better to rent and get to know the neighborhood, the places that you're going to want before you make that decision.
This is a really big decision. I mean, once you've made a down payment on a home, you're in it for the long haul because it's really hard to get that home sold and then to rebuy again. I was thinking too, Jim, especially when it comes to these second homes, or for most people, these are vacation homes. There's sort of this thinking that, okay, I'm going to buy so many extra bedrooms because I know so-and-so is going to come and visit and the kids are going to come and visit. I think one of the things that renting for a little while before you buy does is show you, okay, how many people really are coming to see me? Do I really need that extra room? Do I really need this extra square footage? So again, just sort of doing a little bit of a test drive of the whole situation before you put down a whole lot of money on it.
You may end up in the long run renting out your home if you decide to purchase it in the area. That's one way. I have a friend of mine who invests in real estate, and he likes to buy real estate in places he likes to go on vacation. But one of the ways he has found to offset a lot of the cost is he rents the place out. So that helps to recoup the area, and he's very astute in terms of how he buys, getting to know the area. So you could end up renting it. So this will also give you an idea of the availability of rentals in the area. And by the way, the prices your property might be able to command as a rental.
I think this whole idea of doing a seasonal rental of your vacation home is something a lot of people are familiar with. And I think for a lot of people, it's a way to be able to maintain that second property in the family. I know that we have a lot of people for whom that second property is not just their dream vacation home, but they're also planning on passing it down as an inheritance to their kids so their kids can enjoy it as well. I think that there's one thing you have to think about here realistically. If we leave the property to the kids, will they really use it, or will they just resell it and take the cash? But let's just say that leaving a property as an inheritance really isn't part of your planning for the second home or this vacation home. You might want to do a little bit of work to see if it's worth your while, like Jim was mentioning, to try renting instead of buying, not just renting before you buy to check things out, but completely discarding the idea of buying altogether and focusing on renting this dream location.
And, you know, you can pencil these options out by adding up, let's say, the annual cost of owning a second home, the mortgage payments, what's going to cost you for insurance, and don't forget, folks, the maintenance, the utilities. And then also, if you plan on renting it, what's rental management going to cost you? Now, divide that by the number of days you think you're realistically going to spend there each year. And that's a big, big if. We have found with a lot of people that have had second homes, I mean, if you're Larry lots of bucks, well, maybe that's not as important. But if the number you arrive at is roughly equivalent to what you might spend on a rental or a hotel in the same location, it may make a lot more sense just to rent.
I know that that's something we've suggested to people before, too, especially if the new home is in a place they really haven't spent much time in before. You know, definitely renting is an option. So let's just take an example. If a second home is costing you, say, $25,000 a year, as in the case of the wife we talked about earlier, but you're only spending, say, 2 months a year there. But if you look at rentals in the area and you can get a rental for $5,000 or $8,000 a month, net net, you're able to spend a lot less just going and renting for a couple of months than maintaining the property every year. So financially, especially if your budget is tight, again, considering renting as opposed to owning is sometimes maybe something you want to think about.
You know, another consideration that I think most people don't consider, but should it's available, is the healthcare in the area. Think about that. And especially as you get older in age, we never like to think that a bad health situation will come up while we're staying at our vacation home. Think of the actor that just passed away with The Sopranos, where he was on vacation and died of a heart attack. So it's something that does come up. So you want to take a look at what are their health facilities that are nearby, what kind of care. And this may be especially important if you have, for example, a chronic health condition.
I was thinking too, Jim, that if you're thinking about picking up this second home, something else to think about too is if it's going to allow you to continue to vacation there gracefully as you age. In other words, I know recently you talked to Lewis Tenenbaum on the show about elder-friendly home design. So I think it's something else to think about. We normally just don't fathom when we're thinking about buying that vacation home is how many steps does it have? Is it wheelchair friendly? Are there good wheelchair accesses in the restrooms? Is it easy to maneuver around? Is it easy to get to? So these are things too that if you're planning on visiting that vacation home for as long as possible, you'll want to make sure that it's set up so you can enjoy it for as long as possible without too much hassle.
Well, as we wind up this session, if you are planning for cost and for the ability to rent or resale if needed, owning a second home in retirement, especially as a legacy for your children, or owning a second home can be a viable and actually an enjoyable option. But remember, you need to plan for it. You need to figure in all the costs that we've been talking about. And it also applies if you're thinking of relocating. Maybe you spent your working career working on the East Coast or someplace else. Your kids have moved out. They moved to an area. You want to move near them. And don't forget, sometimes kids get transferred, especially in this modern age of ours. So think about these things, but make sure you have a plan and think of these things before you actually put that down payment. I know you're visiting, you're on vacation, you see that beach house or that place on the lake, and it appears so charming. You're thinking, oh, would it be nice to own this? But once again, think about how much time you're going to actually spend there. You may be better off just renting.
I think this is a really critical thing for people to consider, Jim, because if you plan well, having that vacation home in retirement can be a fantastic place to spend time with family and friends, a good place to get away from it all. For a lot of people, it's a good place to get away from seasonal weather, for example. But unfortunately, if you don't plan well, sometimes purchasing a second home can lead to some pretty tough choices about making sacrifices in your budget or in your lifestyle or keeping the property.
Well, Kathleen, it seems like when we're on this program and doing this show, we can't seem to get away from budgets. Oh, well, folks, it's just part of retirement planning, and it's necessary. Now, we're going to move on to the second half of today's program, which also involves budgets as well. This is the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, which was intended to extend insurance to more families and individuals who didn't already have coverage. But who will be able to participate in the insurance exchanges set up by the Affordable Care Act, and how much is this insurance going to cost? What are the penalties? That's what we're going to be discussing in the second half of today's program with my discussion of Herb Schultz. He's the regional director of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, coming up right after this. Joining me on Lifetime Income this week is Herb Schultz. He's Regional Director of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And Herb, before we get started, the Affordable Care Act begins on October 1st. What we're hoping to do here is if you can provide our listeners with information about enrollment, how, where, when, not just the October 1st date, but will there be, for example, enrollment deadlines, eligibility windows for Social Security, Medicare, deadline to enroll, etc. So why don't we begin there? How does the health insurance exchange relate to Medicare and Medicaid?
Well, thank you for having me on. And first, let me acknowledge that we are at a milestone in 100 days. Millions of Americans, people who buy coverage on their own, people who buy coverage for themselves and their families, and small businesses under 50, 100 days from today, will have health insurance coverage. And that starts on January 1st if they have enrolled by December 15th. And so you're exactly right. We're at the start on October 1 of an extensive six-month open enrollment period. For those on Medicare, they do not need to worry. They already have credible coverage under the Affordable Care Act, and they do not have to sign up for anything else. They have their Medicare, and they're taken care of and don't need to worry. In terms of Medicaid, there are individuals who make under $16,000 a year for the first time, regardless of disability. Individuals making under $16,000 a year or families of four under $33,000 a year, and they will be eligible for a comprehensive, affordable health insurance plan under Medicaid at little or no cost. That's a lot of childless adults in the Medicaid population, and that is for those who are, again, can begin to enroll starting in October 1, coverage on January 1 for those that enroll by December 15th.
You said something there that's very important, Herb, and I just want to reemphasize this with our listeners. If you are enrolled in Medicare or going to enroll in Medicare, this isn't going to impact you.
That is absolutely correct. Those on Medicare need not worry. They have coverage, and they'll continue to have coverage in the way that they have had that, not through these new marketplaces.
And does any of that Medicare coverage change under this law?
Well, under the Affordable Care Act, the Medicare program was strengthened in a couple of very important ways. Under the Affordable Care Act, Medicare beneficiaries, seniors 65 and over, people who are disabled, have been able to see that preventive health care services, so mammography, pap smears, cancer screenings, nutritional, food and counseling, all of those preventive health screenings, there no longer can be a copayment or a deductible, an out-of-pocket cost in order to get those screening services, if you will. So very important that seniors now have and people with disabilities the ability to make sure that they get these preventive health screenings and there's no out-of-pocket cost associated with them. They also get, as a part of those preventive health screenings, a free annual wellness visit with their healthcare provider to talk about their chronic conditions, the management of those, to have a general check-in around maintaining, if you will, good health. The other thing is that there have been 6.5 million seniors and people with disabilities in this country that have saved approximately $7 billion on discounts on their prescription drugs. Under the prescription drug law initially, there got to a point for people with high prescription drug costs that they could be forced to spend 100% on prescription drugs, that they would have to put all of that money out of their pocket. And no senior or person with a disability should ever have to choose between food and medicine. And so the Affordable Care Act is eliminating, over a 10-year period, that so-called donut hole. So it's provided significant financial assistance to ensure that our seniors, our people with disabilities, are able to afford their prescription drugs, and very important for health. As I indicated, more than 6.5 million seniors, approximately $7 billion saved over the last 3 years that this part of the Affordable Care Act has been in existence.
Let's talk and move on to these healthcare exchanges. How does one qualify to participate in these exchanges, let's say if you want to get coverage?
Well, thank you very much. It's a very important question. And so there is one single application, and individuals can go to healthcare.gov or cuidadodesalud.gov, its Spanish language counterpart. There are some states that are running their own state-based exchanges, but anyone going into healthcare.gov or cuidadodesalud.gov can basically link to the best way. But in one single application, a very short 3-page, one single application in English and Spanish, individuals who buy coverage on their own, individuals buying coverage for themselves and their families, or small businesses will be able to complete a short application and be able to then have the knowledge of whether or not they can get healthcare coverage at low or no cost through Medicaid, or whether they may be eligible for premium assistance. In other words, advanceable tax credits that will help them pay for their premiums. Some even more low income will be able to get discounts off of those out-of-pocket costs as well. And so those who are eligible for this marketplace, individuals buying coverage on their own for themselves or themselves and their family, and small businesses, will be able to, beginning on October 1, they can go online, they can do it through the mail, they can do it by working with a enrollment counselor at the local level, many different ways in which to enroll, on the phone, in person, through the online, or with an enrollment counselor.
What benefits, Herb, are being offered through these exchanges? If I go through the exchange and I get a policy, what are the benefits?
Well, you know, the benefits are a comprehensive benefit plan at an affordable price. And again, I mentioned that some will be eligible for premium assistance and maybe help with their out-of-pocket costs as well. Things like physician services, hospitalization, prescription drugs, maternity and newborn care. There is a prevention, wellness, and chronic disease management provision. There's oral and vision care for children and other things like rehabilitative care, mental health and substance use disorder benefits. So it's a comprehensive package. And consumers now actually can go to a 24/7 telephone line, 1-800-318-2596, and they can go on even today, English and Spanish with translation into more than 150 languages, to begin to ask about the types of things that you're asking about 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
And Herb, can you maybe contrast, like, a lot of individuals, for example, work at companies, they have private insurance, let's say through Blue Cross, Blue Shield. Will these policies that they're able to get through the exchanges, will they look pretty much or similar?
Well, the exchange concept in and of itself is really to be able to ensure that a bigger group of individuals or individuals with families, or in the case of small businesses, that they can be banded together, similar to the way that large companies are provided insurance, in order to, one, make sure they can get a comprehensive benefit, but also at an affordable price. So, yes, it is meant to take, if you will, the buying power of the market and make sure that you can bring individuals in. Remember that starting on January 1 in these new plans, when 100 days from today, millions of Americans will have coverage, many for the first time, nobody with a pre-existing healthcare condition, whether they have one or they have had one, can be denied coverage, nor can their premiums, the monthly premiums, reflect that they have or have had a pre-existing condition. That's historic. And so these marketplaces or exchanges will operate in a very, very comprehensive and meaningful way.
Staying on the exchange, let's take a person that has a pre-existing condition. Will that affect the coverage through the exchanges? And if so, how?
No, it will not. In healthcare reform through the Affordable Care Act, nobody can be denied health insurance ever again because they have a pre-existing condition, and nobody can be charged more because they have or have had. For over 3 years now, children under 19, it has been prohibited. It's illegal to deny a child health care because of a pre-existing condition. But starting on January 1, nobody in this country can be denied health insurance because of a pre-existing condition, nor can they be charged more because of that.
What options are currently available through the exchanges, and is there any idea what these are going to cost, and will that vary just like normal insurance according to age?
Well, in the marketplaces, there are four levels of benefits that can be offered, and those go from anything from a plan where the plan pays 60% and the individual pays 40% in terms of their out-of-pocket costs plus their premium, all the way up to a 90% that the plan pays. But the important thing regarding that is that, one, as I indicated, we believe a substantial percentage of those that are utilizing these new marketplaces will be eligible for these advanceable premium tax credits, or, if you will, premium assistance. There are small business tax credits as well that are already in effect. A study by HHS recently showed that approximately almost 6 out of 10 uninsured in the country who utilize these marketplaces may be able to get insurance coverage for under $100 a month. But it's important that October 1 is the date that everybody will be able to start to see in their state and in their area what plans are available to them. And there is a comparison tool, a calculator, so they'll be able to go through that and compare and contrast what best meets their budget, what the benefits are that they have. There's also a web chat feature. So in real time, anyone that's sort of comparing on their own and has questions can dialogue with an operator, not just on the phone, but can dialogue in real time, again, in English or Spanish, questions that they have about what they are looking at.
Are there any tax credits for participating in the exchanges? In other words, if I don't qualify for, let's say, the tax credits, would I be better off just, for example, going into the private market and buying insurance directly from an insurance carrier?
Well, there are two types of tax credits that are appropriate to mention, and I'm very happy to mention them. One is the advanceable premium tax credits. In other words, premium assistance for individuals buying coverage on their own, buying coverage for them and their families. But there also are small business tax credits. Whether you're a for-profit or a tax-exempt employer, you have the ability, you must get the coverage through the marketplace in order to take advantage of those tax credits. But the same plans that are being made available in the marketplace also have to be made available outside the marketplace in the private sector under the same rules. So you can get it through the marketplace or you can get it in the private sector if you can take advantage of that premium assistance for small business credits. You must do it in the marketplace. But the plans actually have to be provided under the same rules and prices as they are inside that marketplace.
Herb, I want to talk about the enrollment date and then move on to penalties. Let's say that for whatever reason, it isn't made clear to a lot of individuals that you have, like, from October 1st to December 15th to enroll to get coverage beginning January 1st next year. Is there an additional enrollment period, number one? And number two, is there a penalty if I don't enroll during that period of time?
Well, the open enrollment period is an extensive 6-month open enrollment period. For those who have coverage by December 15th, 2013, their coverage will begin on January 1. There are rules in place. Ultimately, if somebody does not get coverage through the marketplace at a timely basis, the individual penalty provisions do apply in 2014. But there is a provision that allows if there is a gap, if you will, of less than 3 months, somebody may still meet the tenets of the individual requirement and not be penalized. So the important thing to focus on is that December 15th date, because coverage becomes effective on January 1.
Let's talk about penalties. Let's say that for various reasons, individuals decide not to sign up. Let's take a young person, or even, let's say, a family. They decide that they don't sign up. Or, let's say, a business. What are the penalties for individuals and for businesses if they don't sign up?
A couple of different things. Let me talk about the business side of it first. The penalties associated with the business are for those businesses that are 50 and over. And those 50 and over employers that have 50 and over employees, 96% of them already provide health care coverage. In 2015, that is when the employer shared responsibility or penalty provisions go in. So while we encourage employers to begin their reporting, those that are the larger employers, they are not subject to penalties in 2015. They have a decision to make, and that is, do they provide coverage to their employees, or do they, if you will, pay a fee in order to help ensure that the system is working appropriately? When you talk about business under 50 full-time equivalent. And under 50 full-time workers, the full-time in the ACA for this provision is 30 hours per week. But those employers, those under 50 full-time employees, are 96% of all employers in the country. And they are not subject, they're not required to provide health insurance coverage. Many of them do. We have talked with tens of thousands of others that want to be able to do that. But they are not subject to any penalty or requirement whatsoever. If they do not provide health insurance coverage, they are not penalized for those employers under 50 full-time workers. And that, again, is 96% of all of our small employers. The individual responsibility, which kicks in with coverage on January 1, is basically done through the tax system when an individual or an individual with a family would file their taxes in 2015 for the 2014 year. And those penalties are $95 or 1% of income. That's for the individual. The greater of $95 or 1% of income. The second year, 2015, that's $325 or 2%, whichever is greater. And in 2016, that's $695 or 2.5%, the greater of, and then it gets indexed to inflation. Now, the 95, the 325, and the 695 are individual. If you times that by 3, that would give you what the family penalty would be as opposed to the individual penalty. but that does go into effect for the taxable year in 2014, and therefore will be something somebody would work through on their taxes that they're doing by April 15th of 2015.
Herb, how should a consumer evaluate the options available to, let's say, him or her through the exchanges to determine which one's best?
Well, you know, there's a lot of ways in which to do that. Consumers can already go up, as I said, on the toll-free line. If they're on the website or they're working with an enrollment counselor, they can be asking questions. So 1-800-318-2596. But there's a comparison tool. And there's lots of opportunity, either if they're doing it on their own, to sort of put in what they're looking for in a calculator. They can look across all of these different plans to look at the co-payments, the out-of-pocket costs, the benefits, because remember, the essential benefits are there. And so the differences will be in terms of co-payments and deductibles. So they can look and see if they already have coverage. There may be individuals or individuals with families or small businesses that already have coverage and want to look to see if they get a better deal. So they can go in on the calculator and they can put that information in and they can compare and contrast that. They can be sitting with an enrollment counselor and asking those questions. They can work with an agent and broker, which are still, our agents and brokers are a critical part of the system. They can be, if you will, online chatting with a customer service representative who actually can help explain those plans to them and what they're doing. So there'll be the customer service representatives on that 1-800-318-2596 line.
Herb, we've heard that not all of the states have adopted some of these exchanges. Can you bring us up to date on which states are currently participating in the health insurance exchanges?
Well, there will be 50 marketplaces across this country. Regardless of whether the state runs one or there's a partnership between the state and the federal government, or they are federally facilitated, there will be 50 online marketplaces with the ability to also meet with local counselors. A state at their option can expand the Medicaid program up to, as I said, under roughly $16,000 a year for individuals, $33,000 for a family of four, and that is a decision with which the state makes. But the marketplaces or exchanges themselves will be open for open enrollment on October 1 for coverage beginning January 1, all 50 states. And then in a subset of the states, Medicaid will expand. But there's been an increasing number of states that continue to either come into the Medicaid expansion or to be debating and signaling their interest in coming into that Medicaid expansion.
Finally, as we close, Herb, can you give out the websites that individuals need to go to find out, number one, information, two, to sign up, and is there a phone number that individuals can call? I would think they'd be better off going online, but that's just my own experience, but I'd like to get your input on that.
It's very important, as you said that, because for a lot of people, they will go online. And those 50 online marketplaces will open October 1. That's healthcare.gov, healthcare.gov, gov like government. The Spanish language counterpart, cuidadodesalud.gov, that's C-U-I, D as in David, A, D as in David, O, D as in David, E, salud, S-A-L-U-D.gov. There is, as I indicated, a 24/7 marketplace call center, which is already opened, and that is 1-800-318-2596. It's also important to note that there is a marketplace, the Small Business Health Options Program, otherwise known as SHOP, for those small businesses under 50. There is a call center that is 9 to 5 Monday through Friday, and that is 1-800-706-7893. In the states where they will be running their own marketplace, I represent Region 9 and California, Nevada, and Hawaii have state-based marketplaces, somebody can go into the website and click on their state, and the state-based marketplaces will have their own websites, their toll-free numbers, their applications to sign up. So anybody can come in through this main healthcare.gov or cuidadodesalud.gov and make sure that they get to and will get to the appropriate place for them.
Herb, I want to thank you for coming on the program because October 1st, it's going to be upon us very shortly here, and there's a lot of questions out there. I appreciate you taking the time to apprise our listeners of how they can take advantage of the program and all the features of it.
Thank you very much. It's great to be with you and really appreciate your willingness to talk with us today.
All right, Herb, listen, thanks for coming on the program. Thank you so much. I'm sure as we get into this, either towards the end of the year or next year, I hope you'll come back again.
Absolutely.
Well, that concludes my interview of Herb Schultz. He's Regional Director for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Hope you find this helpful because a couple key dates you heard him talk about during that interview, the sign-up period, which goes from October 1st to December 15th for coverage that would begin in January. We talked about the exchanges, the differences, sites where you can go to get information, and also some of the penalties. On behalf of Kathleen Harris and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.